KALW.
And I'm not judging anybody who's saying they don't think we should be open at all. I don't care.
Hair salon owners in the Tri-Valley are finding creative ways to protest the health guidelines that are keeping them shut.
I guess I'm a rebel with a cause.
We'll hear what that means. Then, how artists are using their talents to bring awareness about the census.
Seeing them all work together has just been really potent, you know, and just indicative of this needs to mirror the perspective of the census that everyone counts.
And a San Francisco author reads from her latest novel.
It's about a beautiful pharmaceutical executive who pleads guilty in a whistleblower lawsuit and self-surrenders at Alderson Women's Prison.
That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Earlier this month, a group of East Bay hairstylists and salon owners gathered outside Flaunt Hair Designs in Pleasanton. They were there to plot ways to convince public health officials to let them open up. And the group agreed to stage a mass hair salon reopening in defiance of stay-at-home orders. The date was set for Monday, August 17th. And KALW Justice reporter Holly J. McDee joins me now to talk about how that went down. So, Holly, what happened yesterday?
So, yesterday, hundreds of salons, as well as tattoo shops and barber shops all around California, they had pledged to reopen in defiance of the stay-at-home orders. And these business owners argue they can reopen safely, even if they're in a county on the state's COVID-19 watch list. So, as far as I can tell, a lawyer for the Professional Beauty Federation of California, he told the Mercury News that he believes that thousands of salons have reopened for business yesterday, but they're not all shouting on the rooftops about it.
Mm-hmm. And what were people saying? Who did you talk to?
So I spoke with Christine Palmer, the owner of Flaunt Hair Designs in Pleasanton, and she's the one who organized that planning session of hair salon owners and stylists in her parking lot earlier this month. And so she's really eager to reopen.
Hey, we'll stimulate the economy, and society as a whole will feel a lot better because they won't have gray roots and their hair won't be in their face.
I mean, I hear that, Holly.
And her daughter is a hairstylist, and the plan before the pandemic was that her daughter would step in and buy the salon, and she could retire and travel the world, and instead, her business has been shut for these last few months.
The current state of things is not really good. We've been without our income since, March 17th, and that's a long time not to have income. Some of us maybe were able to do a PPP loan. Some of us maybe were able to do unemployment. But it doesn't make up for the income we were making and paying our bills on. I have literally lost 4 hairstylists. So I don't know that my business is going to survive.
August 17th was the date set for a mass day-long reopening in protest. But in the end, Palmer decided not to reopen yesterday.
Why? What happened?
She decided she didn't want to risk the fines or losing her business license. And so instead, what happened was she did open up her shop yesterday, but it was more so for tours, media tours, to get the message out. So she called on reporters to come down. She did invite public officials to come by and see her salon, but she says that none of them showed up. But yes, so when I spoke with her, she gave this analogy comparing the police and public officials to parents.
So the only way to actually convince our parents that we can open safely is to let's show them, come in. I am completely compliant. I did not stay out after curfew. I lived up to my curfew and I'm doing everything I can to show you I can follow your rules.
So then do you think that this will work, what she's saying and what she's doing?
They're certainly trying to get people's attention. There's not really been any signs that Alameda County health officials, for instance, have any plans to allow salons to open up in the county, even outdoors. In Alameda County, reopening is on pause right now because hospitalizations and case numbers are so high in that county. And Palmer argues that her business is in Pleasanton, where right now the number of COVID-19 cases is much, much lower than in places like Oakland and Hayward, where we've seen these really high spikes in cases.
In our county, if we're going to go the numbers game, we're never going to win it. So stop judging us on the entire county's numbers. Put us in a group by yourself and judge us on our numbers. Judge us on our protocols.
So for now, at least, people like Palmer and others are trying to get the attention of public officials so that they don't feel compelled to defy these orders.
Okay. Thanks, Holly. Holly J. McDeed is KLW's justice reporter. You can find more of her stories at klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Right now, so many of us are concerned about the coronavirus, also the upcoming election. But there's something else you also may want to keep on your radar, the census. The deadline to respond and be counted is September 30th, a month sooner than the original date. The Census Bureau says they're pushing it up to make the deadline for the president to receive the data by December 31st. Activists and census experts are concerned the new deadline would cause an undercount of people of color, immigrants, and residents of rural areas, which would mean less federal funding for these marginalized groups. That's why artists like Amy Kish are using their talents to urgently get the word out about the census. Amy is founder of Art Plus Action Coalition. It uses art to inspire civic participation. She partnered with the Yerba Buena Center and launched the digital art campaign, Come to Your Census. It features images, films, and discussions online to remind people to be counted. KALW's Janae Darden spoke with Amy Kish.
Who or what inspired you to be an artist?
I think I just always, I have different artists in my family. But you know, so there was always music around, there was always art around, there was always an invitation or an expectation from my parents to look at things critically, whether it was art or not, and to ask questions about reality, and kind of what the reality was being presented in front of you, what its value was, what the perspective was. And so I think that kind of cultivated this notion of seeing differently and understanding that everybody else around me is seeing it differently in their own way, and to try to kind of digest and understand and synthesize those different views are really what, you know, makes us citizens and participants, you know, in our communities. My heart has always been around the intersection of art and social change, for sure. Just that's like, and even the art, you know, when I was at Sotheby's for many years, and then I left and launched, hey, can you help us launch this private selling platform? Can you help us, you know, with this art fair? Can you help me build my collection? And I said, I really enjoy that so much more than being in the auction house 100 hours a week. But the art that I was really drawn to, that I felt I could really do a good job around, was art that really looked at these issues of, you know, society, culture, our roles, power, all of these different kind of political movements.
Yeah, no, and a lot of artists, that's, you know, what they have to do is, depending on what you're doing, you may not get paid a lot. You have to have, you know, what they say, your side hustle, which Sotheby's is not. That's not a bad side hustle.
Yeah. Well, they pay like a nonprofit, so don't get it. I wish they paid like they weren't a nonprofit. Yeah. They didn't even, I mean, that's a joke. We all joke, all of us who have worked there. I mean, they don't even give you free coffee. You have to go buy your coffee upstairs.
Are you serious? Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm shocked. So now you're here, you're in the Bay, and 2020 is the year of not just coronavirus, It is the year of the census.
Yes, indeed.
And I feel like people have forgotten about the census.
Yeah.
Understandably, because we're in the midst of a pandemic.
But even before the pandemic, this really wasn't on many people's minds.
True.
In my spheres, and in a lot of spheres. And frankly, before I was approached to work on this project, I didn't really know much more about the census other than, you know, they count you. And I was appalled that I had no idea that this is how all power and money were distributed in the United States. And that, you know, you only get this opportunity every 10 years. It's almost more important than voting. Everybody's very focused on the vote this year, but without a proper census count, the vote doesn't mean anything because it determines the electoral college. And that for each person that does the census, $20,000 does or does not go into your community. And it doesn't matter if you're a citizen or not. Everybody is supposed to do it because, for example, the census determines emergency relief. So if there's an earthquake, they need to know, are there 50,000 people in that area or 100,000? Doesn't matter if you're a citizen, if you're undocumented, whatever it is, the money is allocated based on that. And so, and there are particularly like at least 20 groups that are hard to count and vulnerable to an undercount because they're nervous about being seen and heard, especially during the current administration. And so when some of these communities, whether they're immigrant communities, limited English proficient, LGBTQ, whatever it is, don't complete the census, then those areas, they don't get the funding for libraries, for parks, for, you know, healthcare, for all of these things, for food assistance that those neighborhoods need. And I think that in many ways, it behooves the current administration to make sure that people still don't know and that people still don't do it, which is why there was all that kind of rhetoric around adding a citizenship question to the census. Or even if they had added it, it doesn't mean anything because whether you're a citizen or not, you're still supposed to complete the survey because you're living on this ground at this time. So many of us just have no idea. Of course, every year there are these huge campaigns around voting, but because this only happens every 10 years, there isn't the same kind of continuity that happens. And so for many reasons, none of us know that this is really more vital for us all to do. And unlike voting, where you at least have to be 18, you can be any age and do this. You know, you can be like a 12-year-old who understands how important this is and make sure your whole family does it, you know? So this is really our only fully inclusive democratic act that we have in this country, that we extend to kids, to elderly, citizens, to non-citizens. Everything else, there's like, oh, you have to be this or you have to be that.
So what's the, so I know this, you know, you're using your art, you're bringing artists together, working mm-hmm. with the city to get the word out about the census. So yeah. What exactly is your organization doing?
Right. So when they approached me and asked me to develop a campaign, I think they had in mind like some posters or an exhibition or a mural. And once I understood what was at stake, I said, we got to do a lot more than just one little thing. We need to build a coalition of anybody who already understands what's at stake or anybody who wants to understand so that we can all come together, pool our resources, leverage our networks to spread this message as far and wide as we can. And then basically we said, all right, to really reach the most people, we need to do a kind of a four-pronged thing. One is a public media campaign consisting of billboards, transit shelters, kiosks all over the city of San Francisco and every neighborhood we have the funds to reach. Number two is public programming, where we go out and meet people in community where they are. We partner with tons of different community-based organizations or individuals who are trusted messengers in those communities to do outreach. Number three is that this is the inaugural digital first census where everybody can do the census and is being invited to do the census online. And while that may seem like, oh, great, so easy, everybody can do it, there are huge issues, even in a city like San Francisco, of digital access and digital literacy. So we've been trying to brainstorm with, OCEA, the Office of Civic Engagement and Immigrant Affairs, and any of our other coalition partners to try to find what are the opportunities where people are bringing, let's say, whether it's food or art supplies. One of our partners is Creativity Explored, and they work with differently abled artists. And so a lot of their artists who are sheltered in place, they don't have the ability to go get their own art supplies. So the teaching artists for Creativity Explored are delivering art supplies. So we've started some conversations with them to say, hey, when your teaching artists are going and delivering the supplies, is there any way they could ask whether the artists and their families have taken the census so that they can do it, so that we're overcoming, maybe these folks aren't online looking at all this, these different things. What are the ways that we can do that, whether it's in-person visits or, you know, kind of using old school phone trees, you know, like calling people up and saying, hey, have you done your census? And also finding out from OSEA, what are the ethics around? All right, I'll walk you through it. I'm in front of a computer. I'm going to ask you these questions. I'll put in your information for you. So trying to find what are the ways that we reach those folks that don't have that aren't connected digitally right now. I think that is the biggest challenge. And I think one of the most compelling and meaningful elements of this whole project, the Come to Your Census project with the Art in Action Coalition, has been really that we've taken a collaborative approach throughout the entire thing, because how can you be asking people to participate in something that's about everybody being seen and heard if you don't have a multitude of perspectives and voices in it? So from our curatorial committee, which is, we have this amazing committee assembled, you know, Thashara Akindayo and Krista Oropeza and Dorothy Santos and Nikki Meng and Roz Nash and Sarah Cathers and Brittany Ficken and Isabel Uruguayan and, you know, like just everybody. And to all of our artists and all of our folks, all of the artists are listed on our site, you know, from Emery Douglas, Ana Teresa Fernandez, Lava Thomas, like, I could go on and on and on, you know, even youth artists, you know, Isha Thorne, Graffiti Camp for Girls, all these different artists that we're working with. And seeing them all work together has just been really potent, you know, and just indicative of like, this needs to mirror the perspective of the census that everyone counts.
That was Amy Kish, founder of Art Plus Action Coalition, speaking with KALW's Janae Darden. We'll have a link to the Come to Your Census campaign at KALW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Bay Area authors have had to cancel launch parties and book tours because of the coronavirus, so we're bringing them to you in this series we're calling New Arrivals. Today we hear from San Francisco author A.H. Kim reading from her new book, A Good Family.
It's about a beautiful pharmaceutical executive who pleads guilty in a whistleblower lawsuit and self-surrenders at Alderson Women's Prison. The following passage comes early in the book and describes the drug that would cause the rise and the fall of the main character. How hard would it be to reformulate Metamine into a chewable compound, I ask. I rip open a bag of gummy colas and offer it to him for inspiration. Dr. Stanley reaches into the bag and takes a handful. He chews as he listens to my pitch. One of the things that always comes up during my sales visits, I continue, is just how much parents hate making their boys swallow the pills. And to make matters worse, they have to do it 2 or 3 times a day. These parents say they would do anything, pay anything, to avoid the daily battle. So my question to you is this. What if we made it so that boys actually want to take their Metamine? Dr. Stanley swallows hard. I see his prominent Adam's apple bob up and down. A new drug formulation triggers a new period of exclusivity. It basically resets the clock for making money and gives the drug company another slug of time without competition from generics. We look at one another and feel the electricity between us. It's better than sex. We've just invented gummy Ritalin.
That was San Francisco author A.H. Kim reading from her new book, A Good Family. Find more information on that and other books at kalw.org/newarrivals. And before we leave you, here's some new music from a local artist. This is Bob Thayer from San Francisco. His new album, Summer Leaves, came out earlier this year. ¶¶ Today's Cross Currents team includes Noor Bouzidi, Julia Linus Goodman, Lisa Morehouse, Marissa Ortega Welch, and Joshua Sorotiak. Our engineers are James Rollins and Gabe Graben. Production manager is Shirin Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.